Om Shanti. I really am happy to have this chance to share something of my journey towards understanding the mind, because I've been a slow learner and I've picked up some valuable lessons, partly through just sticking at it over a 35-year period now. When I was about 13, I remember making some inquiries about religion and spirituality and psychic things. And I was drawn to it, but I couldn't make out what was going on. And so somehow something in me decided to live in a very materialistic way instead. That seemed more reliable. You know, I was born in February 1944, towards the end of that huge war that convulsed a lot of the world. And my generation, we tended to be quite hedonistic. I don't know if you are able to translate this word. It means like just thinking that rather than have big high ideals, let's just get on with life and make things happy for ourselves, because when you have big ideologies, they can cause so much trouble. Millions dying. And so I was part of that generation, the fun-loving 1960s, swinging London and all of that. And that seemed like a good position to take. And also I was drawn towards science, even though I didn't study science. I studied literature and economics academically. But when I started working as a journalist, I was drawn towards science and medicine as a subject of reporting, partly for similar reasons, that I liked the scientific method to try to establish things in a firm, clear way, you know, that were repeatable and measurable, instead of relying on human superstition or intuition or whatever. And so I lived my life on that basis as well. Got married young, had a family young. We were both working hard in our careers, me and my wife, and everything going okay until I was getting into my mid-30s, and then it started to feel like a treadmill, like just going round working hard to make money to keep the parties going and the dinner parties and the friendships and the house and the car and the entertainment for the children. It seemed limited, and it seemed to be lacking in some juice, you know, some essence. It was okay. To others it might have seemed like a very good life, but it was felt increasingly empty. Lacking in love, really, I would say now, looking back. Lacking in real love. It was because by living in that externalized way, I was, all my mental energies were going into things outside, and so there was no nourishment from the deeper dimension that I now understand that the mind is also capable of accessing. When you're divorced from that deeper dimension, you become, as Baba says, like an orphan. And orphans traditionally are thought of as unfortunate, because they don't have that love and care and place in the world that someone whose parents are around to nourish them has. So this orphaned feeling, along with realizing as I studied medicine more closely for my work, and realized that quite often the seeming wonders of medicine, you know, an ill for every pill, or rather a pill for every ill, was also bringing an ill from every pill. That sometimes you would find that what seemed like really helpful and could be very helpful to people in the short term might save lives. But in the long run, when we were relying on medical solutions to problems that would lie deeper inside the mind, then it wouldn't work. And in time, if you kept relying on a pill or surgery or whatever, then the problems became deeper and the side effects of the treatment started to exceed the benefits. This became very clear to me as I worked as a medical correspondent. And medicine's a very open profession. They would discuss these problems in their journals. So I learned a lot. And it resonated with this feeling in myself that my life was not on a good trajectory. This materialism, the narrowness of it, even though it wasn't meant to be a selfish life, it was meant to be a life of giving to family and work, but somehow the motivation wasn't right. Because when you are orphaned in that way, when you are cut off from that deeper dimension of mind, and of course from God, then gradually the lack of spiritual nourishment comes through in the way that you think and act. And so that dryness starts to affect your thoughts, your actions, and of course the return of your actions. And so this was the problem that I found in my own life, and I saw that it was affecting many others too, that unhappiness, a lack of a place in the world, a lack of being able to make sense of life, lay behind many forms of illness, was the root cause of many forms of illness. And that when people found a new sense of purpose, there could be real transformation. Even illnesses that might otherwise have proved lethal, terminal, people would sometimes stage dramatic recoveries when they found a new place in the world for themselves. Or if they found that, especially if they found that deeper, what I keep referring to as that deeper dimension of mind. Now let me tell you something about what I've learned about mind. The way that I used to think of mind was as a product of the brain. That's how 99% of neuroscientists, brain scientists, would consider the mind, even today. They think that it's the incredible complexity of the brain with its 100 billion cells, its 100 billion neurons, that extraordinary city of neural pathways that produces the mind. And they would say, well, we can demonstrate that it does, because if we give you an anesthetic, you become unconscious. Or if we give you a certain type of drug, you might feel happy. So clearly it's the brain that is, you know, producing the mind. But firstly, that way of thinking doesn't actually explain consciousness. It does show that the brain is involved in consciousness and in the mind, but it doesn't explain consciousness. And secondly, there's a whole stack of evidence that's been mounting up in recent years which indicates that mind actually lies deeper than the brain, which of course is what Baba tells us. When I came across the Brahma Kumaris and heard that the mind and the intellect and the sanskars, the predispositions in our character, lay within the soul and not within the brain and the body, I found that very hard to understand. I quickly experienced love and an energy of love in my relationships with the Brahma Kumaris. And that's what drew me and made me a BK. And when I came to India, I also felt the truth of the cycle, because this ancient land, you can see it written into the faces, especially of those who've stayed in this culture right through to this last birth, that on the one hand, the burden of 63 births of a fallen world and all the struggle and and tragedy and drama of surviving in Ravan's kingdom. But on the other hand also those echoes of something greater than Europe has known, that golden age, that age of truth of the past. This came home to me when I first came to India. So that was very helpful in giving me faith at a time when I didn't really have understanding. And as I've indicated, the love that I felt, the not love in a sloppy sense, in a sentimental sense, but just the givingness that I experienced to different degrees from the BK family, from the daddies, of course, who had charged themselves so brilliantly over many decades with this energy of truth. So you would feel that very strongly. But all BKs, even ones who had only perhaps had a year or two of practice of these things, they too, for me, had a different vibration. It wasn't that they were necessarily better people. I worked on newspapers with some extremely skilled and virtuous people. But there was something about this divine energy that I was experiencing through the BKs that was different from the everyday virtue that you might find in good colleagues in good professional positions. So that's what made me a BK. But, as I said, I didn't understand how the mind could be something other than the brain. Because I was, in a sense, conditioned into understanding myself in that body-conscious, brain-conscious way. So, my journey continued, and one of the first times when I got an indication of the power of the mind as something distinct from the brain came about when I hit a sort of crisis in my spiritual journey a few years back, where there was a constant conflict would arise inside me, where on the one hand I was pulled by what Baba was telling me, but on the other hand I had family connections. When I came to Baba, I was married with two children. They were aged 12 and 13 at the time, two sons. And I was very lucky that my wife was interested in the Brahma Kumaris, because I was kind of falling in love with this amazing new world that I was being reintroduced to by Brahmins. But my wife was interested as a kind of sympathetic observer, partly because she's a strong feminist, so she liked the fact that the female principle was put to the fore in the Brahma Kumaris. And she liked the fact that, generally speaking, the men were clean and smelt okay, you know, unlike a lot of men in the world generally. She liked a few very practical things like this. And she was happy to switch to a vegetarian diet, which was very fortunate. And also celibacy. She saw it as a kind of female empowerment, and actually wrote a book in the 1980s called Sex is Not Compulsory, which attracted a lot of interest worldwide. But she wrote it from the point of view of a feminist rather than from a spiritual perspective. So I was lucky in that there was a lot about the Brahmin life that was okay, and our family stayed together for some years. But then, after our sons had grown up, Liz, my ex, said that she felt that we should separate because it seemed our lives were going in different directions. I didn't want that, but it happened. And for some years afterwards, I felt this sense of incompleteness, a sense of loss, because, well, I didn't know why. If I'd known why, I might have been able to deal with it earlier. But a few years back, I finally got this realization that I had a very strong family man identity programmed into my brain. It was affecting the mind, because the mind sort of sits between the soul and the brain. And a lot of what happens in the brain, of course, feeds through to the mind. And our problem comes when we don't nourish the mind from Baba, from that deeper aspect of the self. But the mind is very affected by the brain, and so from time to time I would move along in my Brahmin journey okay. I'd be very happy as I focused on Gyan and Yoga. But then sometimes when I reconnected with Liz, my ex, or with the boys as they progressed in their careers, they got married themselves, 5 grandchildren appeared, all of these things happened. So sometimes it felt like a sadness that the family man who wanted things to be right in that area, it was as if that had been a price that I'd paid sort of unwillingly, the loss of the family man identity. And this got resolved when I realized, about 5 years ago I think, I saw that this family man identity was conditioned in my brain. I visualized it as like a tumor, like a grey mass inside my brain with tendrils that affected a large part of my thinking. Like a complex, you know, a family man complex. The psychologists used to talk of an inferiority complex, how that could affect a person's brain in many different ways and their reactions to life. This family man identity was suddenly seen, instead of seeing it as something that was natural and normal, I saw it as something like a tumor that was influencing my thinking in ways that were negative rather than positive. They weren't allowing me to live in a true way. They were making me live in a conditioned, body-conscious way. And I think this is a very deep lesson that is extremely helpful. It has been very helpful to me, and I feel it may be to others too, because most of us have some kind of conditioning in our brains like this that seems very natural. When we come to Baba, there are certain behaviours which we know are vicious, as Baba calls them, vice-ridden. The vices, they have that grip on us. We can see clearly how they cause us to behave in ways that don't bring happiness, that bring sorrow. And so quite quickly we let go of a lot of the worst expressions of the vices. But some of these subtle vices, such as this one, are harder to spot, harder to identify. And finally recognizing this, seeing it in that form, visualizing it in that form, I was able to perform psychic surgery on myself. It felt like seeing it there, realizing how much it was influencing my spiritual journey, holding me back from time to time. I put my hand in, obviously it's like mentally, but it felt like I put my hand in my brain and pulled this tumor out. Really consciously felt as if this happened. It was an astonishing experience. You've heard of psychic surgery, probably. I think in the Philippines and elsewhere we heard that there were people who can do things with their mind and remove tumors. You never know the truth of these things, but this was like an operation on the self, where it was like a very determined thought following this realization that I did not want that family man identity anymore. It was not something that was right, it was something that was wrong. Up until that time, I'd always seen it as something that was right, and that somehow my Brahmin life had made me go against something that was right. But now I saw, no, my Brahmin life was trying to free me from these body conscious identifications. So this was a successful operation. The ego, because of course it formed a part of the ego, this family mind identity, it was a part of what you could call the ego, which is like a construct of the brain, the identity that you live with day by day. It's a brain conditioning. So the ego was actually quite sensitive for a few weeks afterwards. almost like, you know, you've removed a tumour from the body, and while that heals, that area would be sensitive. So I experienced the success of the operation in that way, and then when it healed, my life was greatly transformed. I've moved forward much, much more quickly in these last few years than I had done previously. The experience demonstrated to me the power of the mind, that when you really want something, when you're really determined, it's as if you can make it happen regardless of past physical conditions and conditioning. There'll be an opportunity to ask questions soon. I just want to put the basics of this talk on the table. But please, if the points where you're not understanding me, just make a mental note and then come and we can try and clarify later. But I'm trying to build up this picture of how incredibly wondrous the mind is. And actually the full title of this talk was going to be, it wasn't put up on the board, but the full title was The Wonder of the Mind, How Gyan and Yoga Restore Its Power. So this is what I've been experiencing. Yes, right from the beginning of my Brahmin life, learning to attune to the vibrations of the divine would be nourishing my mind and making my life much more manageable than it was before. But still, we sometimes in English we call it a glass ceiling, where you're held back in your journey by something you don't recognize. It feels like you're bumping your head against this ceiling from time to time, but you can't see it clearly. And then when finally it manifested in this form of this tumor, and that was removed, and then the healing, and then the sense of freedom that has come since then. And the wonder of it is that the truth of what Baba tells us has demonstrated itself in practical ways too, that since that operation, my ex-wife, who I'd always stayed close with, even after we separated, because we'd lived together for 25 years before the separation, and so we were good friends, but she's come much closer. It's as if she knows that there is no longer that attachment and dependency on my part in the relationship. And I think that was one reason why she wanted us to separate in the first place. So it's as if she feels safer with me now. And also, because I no longer have the suffering associated with that sense of loss, I'm more positive. So that gives me greater strength. I can help her more in through conversation, in the life challenges she faces. And it's the same with my sons and the grandchildren. Previously, when I would be with them, I would lose myself in the pleasure of that. And then when I was away again, I would feel that sense of loss. Now it doesn't work like that. It's much more like a natural flow. When I'm with family members, I'm there for service. It's a special relationship. Of course, I love the grandchildren, but it's not that sense of mine or that body-conscious family man identity. It's more that I'm a soul. I'm playing a beautiful role with different people in my life, and let love flow. So I'm more loving, more naturally loving. And instead of feeling nervous about, am I doing enough? What a shame that the marriage finished. What a pity that there isn't a normal household for the children to come and play in. No, all of that's gone. I just see the pleasure of being with them. I see the benefit that our sons took through what they picked up from the beautiful wisdom of these teachings. And I just see the positive much more. And that's made things much easier all round. So that's one very practical example of how when you push through to a really timely realization, you can make a major change even in an object like the brain. Scientists would generally say, well, you're a prisoner of your brain. In the past, at any rate, they used to think that once your character was established by your mid-teenage years, then that was it. You were a prisoner of whatever had developed inside your brain. Your character was determined by your brain. Now, because of their ability to study the brain much more in much more detail, because of intricate scanning techniques that can show how the brain changes according to how you use it, they've developed this concept that they call neuroplasticity. The brain is plastic. The brain is moldable. They're amazed to find this, because who changes the brain? How do our thoughts change? If you think that you are your brain, it's a complete mystery. But when you understand that the mind is distinct from the brain, then you empower the mind to change the brain. And that's exactly what has happened for me recently. I've seen a dramatic demonstration of the power of the mind to change the brain in a major way. I think when we are stuck in this concept of the mind as something so totally identified with the brain, which is the scientific view until recently, it's very disempowering. Because if you're depressed, you think, well, that's my nature. If you're angry, you feel, well, that's my nature. But what Baba does for us is, by telling us how to connect to him and giving us the experience of what it means to know God, he gives us the power to bring God's power into how the mind functions, and that then gradually and sometimes dramatically and quickly changes the brain, so that the brain becomes more in line with the divine. That's the goal. That's the goal of Karmateet. That's why Baba says that the deities are just, they live in this oneness and they don't need God, because of the purity of the condition of their brains, they of their bodies, which includes their brains, they just live as one. There's no selfishness in the Golden Age. We will definitely be so subtle in the relationships with each other. We won't speak so much. We won't have to study so much. We'll intuitively know what each one needs to do at any moment in time. Just like the trillions of cells in the body, in a healthy body, they all cooperate very naturally. They don't try and do things other than they're meant to do, except when they become diseased. Same in the Golden Age, that we're all like individual cells within this family of humanity, and we will be so beautifully conditioned both by our sanskars of purity, but also the bodily purity that we will have at that time, that there will be no obstacle to unbroken happiness. But now we have the challenge. Baba tells us, like he did this morning, you started out with those wonderful new bodies in the Golden Age, but look what you've become now. So he's very clear, we have to live with this dual reality. And this is where it's so wonderful to re-empower your mind and understand just how incredibly important it is to take care of your mind. Because otherwise, you will be subject to the conditioning of the past. You won't be able to change your nature in the dramatic way that Baba wants us to, if we're to have that deity consciousness by the end of the cycle. You might improve a little bit. You might, you know, some of the worst aspects of the vices you'll be able to manage. But deep transformation also requires, as he says, it requires essentially remembrance, and then study to find out how to deal with things when you lose the power of remembrance. But essentially, it's remembrance. Remembrance, remembrance, remembrance. I didn't understand the importance of remembrance until I realized just how important it is to transcend the influence of the brain. I found it very useful. I found it very useful in my own recent Brahmin journey. It's helped me to develop a totally deep conviction in the beauty and the truth of these teachings, which for many years, although I was a BK, there would be fluctuations because of the influence of the past. Not that those fluctuations have completely gone. I'm far from perfect, but there's enough wisdom now received from Baba to know that when Maya influences me, I know that it is not the truth. I know now that I am not that brain and that conditioning, and I just have to remember to take my mind back to Baba, and I can bring Baba's truth into my present circumstances, and the shadows can be cast away. But I want to emphasize this point of why Baba says, remember me alone. And yet he says, love your grandchildren, love your family, stay with your families, continue to do these things here, but remember me alone. Because it's like we need this corrective. The deities don't have to remember God, he's very clear on that, because they're in a state of truth. But we are not. We're influenced in our conditioning by all sorts of rubbish, as well as by good things that we've inherited from our parents, from our schools, from our upbringing, from traumatic experiences, from all sorts of things that have shaped us, from our past sanskars, from our 63 births of body consciousness. All of that is there, you know, in the background. And so we, with great love for ourselves, with great compassion, we have to constantly come back to this understanding that by taking my mind to Baba, that pinpoint of pure consciousness, of pure love and truth, by taking my mind to that one, I give my mind the strength to see things with Baba's motivations, with Baba's love, with Baba's wisdom and joy, and free myself from the influence of the conditioning that is still in the brain. Do you get the idea? Do you get the idea? It's a phenomenal tool that Baba's giving us to become free from the past conditioning, which is our biggest obstacle and so often unrecognized. So back to the mind. Think of the mind as sitting between the soul and the brain. So, as I move through life, I see, for example, the contents of this hall. I see your faces. I see the time. I see the lights. I see the flowers and everything here around me. I need that information to function as a human being in this world. I'm not just a part of some amorphous consciousness that lies beyond. This is the beauty of life and the drama, that we come from that field of consciousness into these particular parts that we play. And here I need information about the world around me, and my brain is a wonderful tool to give me that. I need that healthy brain to give me accurate information about the world around me. And that feeds through to the mind, so that the mind is able to say, okay, yes, Neville needs to do this and that, and this person needs some help, and this is the time to do that. All of everyday function, the information coming through the senses, processed by the brain, reaching the mind, that's such a valuable part of everyday life. But as I indicated earlier, it's not enough. If you're not also connecting to the divine, to Baba and your own higher truth, then this sense of being an orphan, this sense of loneliness, this sense of dryness, this sense of a lack of love and a lack of meaning, that then grows in your life. And you're so much more subject to your past conditioning. You're completely subject to it if you're not connecting to Baba. Which means that from time to time you may be able to behave as you'd like to, peacefully and kindly, and at other times you'll get upset and angry and maybe nasty. And Baba says, that's okay. You have to accept that you've been round the cycle, you are in these old bodies now, but whenever that happens, realize that what it signals is the need for more remembrance. Let it be a sign to you to take your mind to me and bring into your mind from that other side those positive qualities of love and peace and wisdom and joy that Baba represents. Avyek Baba said once, remembrance means kindness. I thought that was lovely. Remembrance means kindness. It's like when you're in remembrance, you're connected to the Supreme Father, the Supreme Source, and so there's that flow of truth, of love in your life that ensures that your life runs in a true way, that you're giving and nourishing in your relationships and not selfish. But when you forget the Father, your selfish body conscious habits reassert themselves. It's as simple as that. So understanding that principle has made such a difference to me in this last few years of my Brahmin life. It's as if where previously the battery of my well-being, of my mind, would be charged when I went into a centre, for example, or I was with some Brahmins on a service project, and so I'd feel that happiness. But then, in other circumstances, when I was doing my ordinary everyday work or tasks or relationships, it's as if my old sanskars would come in and there would be leakage and the battery would be not drained but would be run down. And then I'd need to recharge with stepping aside or taking a break or whatever. But now I'm seeing the possibility of being more engaged in relationships at the Lokic level, in my journalistic work, in service with the family. More and more of that is now possible because I'm able to do it with Baba as my companion, because I know who Baba is and I know what my mind is, and I know that my mind needs Baba with me when I'm doing things out here. That's made a huge difference. This is the wonder of the mind. But a little bit more before, just a little bit more. I'd like you to know that at the frontiers, science is now really reaching out to try to understand mind. Mystics and esoteric teachers have said for centuries that the mind is really the basis of our living. They've understood that. There was a great book 20 years back by Marianne Williamson in the US where she said, it was called A Return to Love, and she said, thought is cause, experience is effect. By thought she meant thoughts and feelings. What's going on in your mind? Thought is cause, experience is effect. If you're not happy with the effects in your life, you have to change the nature of your thinking. So in other words, recognizing very deeply that what happens in your life is a consequence of your thinking. There's nothing to blame externally. But something Baba makes clear to us, and it's implicit in his teachings, the soul has to become the master again. But the mechanism whereby that works is now being increasingly understood within science, that mind comes first and the material world is secondary to mind. This works at a very deep level. You can understand it in a simple way, just in terms of the senses. For example, a bloodhound, you know, the dog that has fantastic sense of smell, a bloodhound, you give it the handkerchief of someone, and they may have passed 2 days previously, but the dog can find the trail that they took. This is a bloodhound, we call it in English. And a bloodhound has something like, I think it's something like 6 billion smell receptors. I've forgotten the exact number. Compared with 40 million that a human nose has. So it lives in a world of smell. The bloodhound sees the world through molecules that are picked up by its billions of smell receptors. It lives in a world of smell compared with us, who live more through our eyes. Our vision is incredible, how much data we take in through our eyes, much less through us through smell. But a bloodhound, because it lives in that world of smell, you can give it an item of clothing, and just from those few molecules remaining from the person who had the clothing, it can pick up, recognize those few molecules of that person as it goes down the trail that the person might have passed 2 days previously. It can go all the way to find them because it lives in that world of smell. I remember an amazing story in one of our medical journals some years back about a lady in England who had been blind from birth. But she somehow had learned to manage to move around quite well in the city where she lived. And then all of a sudden, in her late 70s, she started bumping into things. And the doctors were puzzled. And they took her in for tests, and they found that it was because she was going deaf. She had learned to build a mental picture of the world in which she lived, the city, so that she could move around quite comfortably through sound. The sound bouncing off objects, lampposts, cars, buildings. She built a picture through the sound reflecting, like a bat's radar or sonar. And when she started going deaf, she was no longer able to create that picture, and that was why she was doubly disabled and bumping into things in that way. So our senses, we can see, give us a picture that is unique to each one of us, and different species live in different worlds according to these signals that we pick up through the senses. But what science is telling us is that it goes much deeper, much more refined than the senses themselves, the gross senses. We live in a world of vibration. Matter is not what it seems. Some scientists now refer to particles of matter as tightly packed vibrations. Everything is vibrational. It's why buildings develop an atmosphere, because they're not just lumps of dead matter. Everything is vibration. And because of that, and because our thoughts and feelings are vibratory too, according to the thoughts and feelings we are living with, We build a picture, we select and create in the world around us, which is constantly in a state of flux. We build a world for ourselves according to what is in our minds. This is a reality. It's not the other way round as we thought for so long, that that I'm unhappy because this happened outside of me. No. It's according to what is happening in my mind that my reality shapes itself. So if I'm experiencing sorrowful vibrations inside, if I have pain or fear predominant in my mind, I will experience fear and pain externally. I will invoke and somehow select situations that connect to the fear that is my standard approach to life. If I'm living with love in my mind, that produces love in my life. So understand that whenever you feel a lack, for example, of love, the answer doesn't lie in looking for love out there. The answer lies in increasing the love in your mind. It's a law. It's not just a magical thing that sometimes happens. It's a law. If I charge my mind with love, and uniquely we're taught as Brahmins how to do that through relationship with God, if I charge my mind with love, automatically that will produce love in my life. It's amazing how much this is now being understood as a law. It works in other ways too. When Daddy Janki first came to London, she had nothing physically. She slept on a door. She had a brick for her pillow. Seriously, I mean, it sounds like a myth, but she really did. She had a brick wrapped in cloth or something as her pillow. And she slept on a door that had been just a makeshift set up. I didn't know her when she came in 1974. I met her first in 1981. But even at that time, the Yagya in London was very small, tiny. Our morning class used to be in a rented community hall. We had to clear up after the darts club of the night before, you know, clear away the beer bottles and that sort of thing. But Daddy never gave a feeling of lacking anything. She always had the feeling that she had everything. And because of her mind being filled with that sense that I have everything I need, that then manifests externally. It works like that. It's amazing. This is the true wonder of the mind. The mind is constantly creating the world that we experience. If I feel I'm so unfortunate, I've got no money, I don't know what I'm going to do in the future because my pension isn't going to be big enough. If you have thoughts like that, you will create an experience of life in which you don't have. You are impoverished. Poverty consciousness creates impoverishment. Wealth consciousness creates wealth. Not millions like Donald Trump or something like that, but wealth consciousness means that whatever you need will come to you when you need it. And that's exactly what we've seen Daddy achieve. So much has been achieved in those 40 years since she came out of India. And it was through the power of her mind, but a mind that was connected to Baba so that it never felt that it needed anything from outside. Always the feeling was there, I have everything I need from Baba. And therefore, Daddy was instrumental. Without any interference, of course she's grown over time as well, but basically she was so advanced when she came that there was virtually zero interference in what Baba needed to do to manifest the infrastructure of the Brahma Kumaris worldwide. That's why she's been such a wonderful instrument, because she felt right from the beginning, my mind is fine because I have Baba. And we can do the same. The scientists are calling this the consciousness-based paradigm. Sometimes they refer to it now as post-materialist science, meaning that mind is primary and the material world is secondary. It's looking more and more like the ancients used to say, that we actually are creating the whole of this world with our minds, moment by moment. They're talking about reality being granular. This is the latest thinking in physics. Time, matter, light, everything is granular. Nothing is absolute. Everything comes in tiny units, moment by moment, split second by split second. Mind is making choices out of the range of possibilities that quantum laws in physics have illuminated, that there's a world of possibilities put out there by this huge drama that we're in, and then mind makes choices out of those possibilities which become fixed. So we are creators of this drama as well as enacting what is already actually in it. So I think it's signalling for traffic control, and then maybe we can move to the last part of this with some questions and answers or comments from yourselves.
I like very much when you tell us about scientific facts and research, new research, because I have had a very religious education, and also I am going to scientific studies, and these two parts are sometimes fighting, and I think that what you tell us can help, that these two parts can work together and to understand ourselves, to understand Baba, and to keep in remembrance, because this is the most important. Thank you, brother, for your wisdom to and share
Thank
with
you.
Us. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is the sister's absolutely right, that for those who have had some kind of faith in science or conditioning by scientific training, it can be difficult to reconcile the usually materialistic outlook that science has been based on with the very deep spiritual perspective that Baba teaches us. But this new paradigm means that conflict finishes. It's resisted, of course, by many scientists who have been trained and conditioned in a particular way of thinking. But it's not fringe science, this new thinking. It's frontier science. It's very leading people from biology, from physics, from neuroscience, who are pressing the case that it's unscientific to continue to believe that matter is the primary reality. There are too much evidence from too many different studies now indicating the primacy of consciousness, of mind, including some studies that have come to public attention, such as the near-death experience. You know, when because of advances in resuscitation techniques, many more cases now of people who have died clinically, their heart has stopped beating, there's no breathing, no brain activity, no electrical activity in the brain, sometimes for minutes, sometimes for hours. And then with these new techniques for resuscitation, they're brought back. And quite commonly, they have an experience to tell of the continuity of their consciousness, even though their body was dead. They call it the near-death experience, but some of the scientists who worked with these cases say, really, it should be called death, and then return. The people don't always have good experiences. There are different levels of consciousness. Sometimes they speak of realizations. Their consciousness is sometimes aware of the surgeons rushing to try to bring them back. And then they see people in a different part of the hospital, relatives, anxious relatives. They see, even though they don't have eyes. It's another indication that the brain and the body are like a filter on reality, in a sense that consciousness, in the wider, deeper sense, is able to know everything. But of course, we need a brain and a body to filter so that we can manage the different parts that we play. Otherwise, we would be overwhelmed by everything. That would be no use to any of us to have everything crowding into our minds. And in fact, some forms of mental illness seem to be when the filter is not working properly and all sorts of voices come in, which may have some degree of reality, but they're no use to the individual. And so those cases, consistently, people describe moving through different levels of consciousness, but they're very aware that they are still a conscious entity, even though their body is finished for the time being. And often they have some realization about their life. Oh, I hurt so-and-so when I said that. I'd never realized before. Or, oh, when I thought I was right in those circumstances, actually, it really wasn't right. And so realization comes sometimes, but then they also often speak of going through a tunnel into a realm of light, which is probably the light that Brahma refers to as the Brahm element, where they feel this sense of a connectedness to the whole. It's like there is some field of consciousness that is different from the space-time that we normally inhabit. Normally we live in this world of three dimensions of space and the one of time. It's like we're in a movie, as Baba says. But when you go beyond the body in this very complete way of death, the individual often feels that they're going into this realm where Baba calls it talky, doesn't he? But then there isn't talking as such. There's no sound, but there are images that people sense connectedness. They sense that long deceased relatives come and speak to them. People that they haven't seen for years, suddenly they're with them. And it's like a dream state. It's probably best understood as a dream state, because when we dream, that's probably also when we're moving beyond the brain into this realm of unlimited consciousness. But Baba tells us that that's not enough, that what we really need is to go to these heights of consciousness in which we connect to the highest. That's why he doesn't really give a lot of attention to what they call the Akashic records and, you know, subtle dimensions in the esoteric sense, because there's mixture in there. Baba takes us just to him. He does take us also to that subtle realm of Brahma, Vishnu, Shankar, those images of recreation, because that's new and pure. He doesn't want us to connect with mixtures from old consciousness. He wants us to go to the seed and the recreation. But these people do also experience it. When they go up very high, they say things like, this love and this joy, is this God? And then some of them say things like, the realization comes, no, this is God's breath. This is what one of them described when she came back. This is God's breath. They got that realization. So God lies even beyond this, you know, this even this realm of light and love, in a sense. That's an emanation from God, but God is that pinpoint, absolutely beyond. And they get a sense of that, although, of course, they can't return there. And then many cases of individual scientists now, like the neuroscientist Eben Alexander, who had an infection of his frontal cortex that put him in a coma for a week, and they thought he was going to die. But then he came back and he just wanted to write and write and write, and he stopped doing his work, and he's become a passionate advocate of the understanding that we are not our brains. We are consciousness from some realm beyond, and love is a principle there that is fundamental. Love is everything, he says. His book, first book, was called Heaven is Real. Not the heaven that Baba has taught us about, of the reality of Satyug, but that there is this dimension of love and joy beyond the brain. Anita Murjani, you may have heard of her book, Dying to Be Me. She's a good example of the power of the mind over matter. She, a businesswoman in Hong Kong, living a very striving life. You pick up from her writing that it was a rather bullying and assertive life, and then but successful in material terms, and then she developed lymphoma, a form of cancer. And she fought it for 4 years. It just took over her body eventually, and she was covered in tumours. And again, she was in a hospital. They thought they'd lost her. She went into a coma. And while she was in that coma, she went to this realm beyond. And when she came back, same thing. She realised that she'd been living her life in a way that wasn't me. This is what she means, dying to be me, you know. It's like a play on words. She had to die because she had not been herself. She had been this artificial self. But when she died, she realized that the real me was love. And when she came back from the coma, she was so clear about that that within 6 weeks, all of the cancer disappeared and she left hospital, and she's become a global speaker about the importance of understanding that we are not our brains and bodies. We are something much deeper than that, and that love is of our essence. There are many accounts like this now, and scientists are being unscientific when they ignore them. Pim van Lommel, a Dutch cardiologist, did a big study in Holland. He recruited several colleagues at 5 hospitals in Holland over a number of years, studying cases where people died clinically and then were brought back, usually heart attack patients. And again, his conclusion is that there is this wonderful realm of consciousness beyond the everyday consciousness with which we live, which we can remember, we can connect to, and draw strength from. So these different studies are all pushing science in the direction of understanding that there is this deeper dimension. And it's actually implicit in some of the physical sciences too. In quantum physics, which studies, originally it was the study of matter at a very tiny level, at atomic and subatomic level, and those guys found that down at that level, all sorts of mysterious things happen, like particles only appear when there's a mind to see them. So this also is contributing to this consciousness-based paradigm, as they're calling it, that we see the world into being, as our recent project stated. This is a reality. What we experience from the mind becomes the external reality. So all of these different pointers in this direction. The quantum theorists say that the quantum field, which is their expression for this deep field of relationship between consciousness and the material world, where the material world manifests from this consciousness, they say the quantum field does not respond to what you want, but to who you are being. That's deep too. So if I am feeling I want something, it means that I'm in a consciousness that I don't have it. And that is the world that I'm creating. A world in which I don't have that which I say I want it. But if I'm in the consciousness that I have it, that then becomes what I create. And you see how this illuminates Baba's statements to us every day so brilliantly. He tells us every day, you are those ex-deities, you are those pure, peaceful souls. Understand that. I'm here now. You are my children. You are my glorious children, my loved ones, originally those perfect ones. But he also gives us the gyan so that we don't make the mistake of thinking that we're already deities. He gives us the gyan. You've been on this huge journey. You've got all of these wrong tendencies inside you, in your sanskars, in your conditioning. Your old souls. You have to live with that reality too. But don't identify with that. Just understand that that is a part of what you have. That's part of your role in Ravan's kingdom. But I'm now lifting you out of Ravan's kingdom into the golden age. So identify deeply with your golden age status, and then that becomes your reality. That's what the quantum physicists are telling us. They're pointing to the mechanism whereby that happens. So yes, thank you, sister. a beautiful reconciliation now is occurring between the scientific and spiritual perspectives. Any other comments or questions?
Thank you for what you shared, Neville. There was two aspects that I'd like to ask about. Firstly, when you talked about that tumour and how you removed it and visualised it, can you just tell us a little bit more, like, did you make it into some kind of ritual or how did you do it? Like, you know, what sort of steps and what did it look like? Because I've been sort of focusing on different archetypes, which are like energies working in my head that grasp my consciousness. And so there's one that I know at the moment that I want to remove, and I've got this severe back pain at the moment, so I can't sit down, and I know it's that. But, you know, I've tried talking to it and telling it things, but it just won't go away. So I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, what actually took place that day that you had that conversation, like, yeah.
Was there another question?
The other one wasn't so much a question. It was more that when you spoke about Marianne Williamson and that book, A Return to Love, I really like that she got all her information from A Course in Miracles. And that's really about like within us is like a divine thought system and the ego thought system, which is basically what Babaji says is soul conscious and body conscious. Mm-hmm. And in that it talks about that there's not really sin. Sin calls for punishment, which then brings guilt. But there's error in perception.
Mm. Mistakes on reality.
That just calls for correction. Mm. And so, I don't know, I just find that really, really helpful to see it in that way.
That's nice. Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks, Janet. In relation to that latter comment, a point was coming to mind as you were speaking. Oh, yes, I remember. Sister Genty, some years ago in London, said very resoundingly, guilt has no place on the path of transformation. I thought that was very interesting when she said that. Meaning that guilt means, if you're guilty, it means you're in body consciousness, actually. You're identifying with your old self. I can understand that guilt has had a part to play in training us in certain behaviours, perhaps in keeping a lid on the vices in the past. But once you're understanding that what Papa is doing is not tinkering and trying to improve your behaviour in an everyday sense. He wants to lift you out of your body conscious identity into the identity of being God's child and the future deity. And so guilt has no path in that. So that reinforces that point that you were making, that yes, mistakes, like and sin in the sense of, I think of that, I like thinking of a sin in connection with the Latin, meaning sine, meaning without. You know, you're without something, you're without wisdom or whatever, and so those mistakes happen. With regard to your first question, I don't think I can be very more helpful, I'm afraid. It was a very instinctive business. It came at the end of a long period of time in which I suffered from this false ego identity without realizing it. I was definitely helped by the visualization, this kind of grey mass. I saw it as something nasty and these tendrils affecting my thinking in so many subconscious and unconscious ways. And so I really could see finally that what I had thought of as central to the core of my decency as a human being was really actually just another body conscious ego illusion influencing me in these negative ways. And so that seeing it in that, visualizing it in that negative way, somehow seemed to help me to take hold of it with my mind's hand and pull it out. But when I came to it, I have to say that this happened in the wake of a visit to London by Daddy Janky, where Daddy had given me a really good kicking, which she used to do from time to time, if she felt that I wasn't on track, I wasn't making proper efforts, whatever it might be. She would sometimes be quite sharp with me. And in this particular visit, I'd been working in an office up at the top of the retreat centre where I live, near Oxford in England. And in 18 years, which it was at that time, of living there, Daddy had never visited this office. But suddenly, she appeared at the door of this office, but this was about 5 years ago, and 4 or 5 years ago, and there she was, tiny little figure, suddenly, and I was sitting at the desk working, and she looked at some papers on a shelf, and then she looked at the bookshelves, because I have a lot of books in there, and she said, "You must have read all those. What's that done for your intellect?" And walked out. So funny. So funny. I was a bit shocked. There was a couple of other episodes during that visit where she was the same. I used to quarrel with Daddy in my heart. When these conflicts were there, I would kind of project them on Daddy. I would think, "What do you know about family life? You tell us to cut our relationships and this sort of thing," you know, not realizing that it's to cut attachment and dependency, which releases love. It's not to finish relationship. It's to divinize it. But I would feel angry and project things in that way when I was still in my family man identity. And then I'd made up my mind, okay, Daddy's coming to London again. Let me show that I've got no quarrel. She's lovely. I'll just be more detached so that I don't hurt when I hear her saying these things. And I went to the airport with Sister Manda from the retreat centre to greet her when she arrived. And Manda had given me a flower to give her, and she came past and took a flower from Manda and from some others who'd come from London. And then when I offered my flower, she just walked on. And then I said, "Daddy, here." And she looked up, she said, "Who are you?" and walked on. She was trying to signal something to me, and I didn't know what, you know. But and we make a mistake if we project on our seniors, especially such wise and deep ones as the daddies, any kind of negativity coming from our own stuff. And I think she'd seen that I was doing something of that, and so she wanted me at least to break that habit. So two or three episodes like that. And then in the wake of that visit, I asked Manda, I asked Sister Jenty, why did Daddy say these things? I said, we don't know. She's just playing, you know. But it didn't feel like she was playing. I think she knew, but she subconsciously, you know, was nudging me to give me the strength to change. So anyway, it was in the wake of that visit that this operation happened and this realization. And when I went back to India the next time and told Daddy about this understanding and this operation, she took my hand and she shook it and she said, this is a wonderful realization. And I'd never heard her say such a thing with so much conviction before, you know. And I'll just tell you the final end of this story, which is funny also. On that visit, she must also have said something to Daddy Gulzar about Neville has finally, you know, understood something about this family man identity. Because when Baba came, at the end of Baba's Murli, and at the end of the session, Daddy Gulzar came back, and as soon as she came back, she spoke to Nilu Ben, who spoke to Hansa Ben, who started gesturing. I was a few rows back, sitting next to Nizar Bai, and I thought they wanted Nizar to go up, because he'd already been up, but I thought they wanted him back. But no, Daddy Gulzar wanted me to come up. So it took me time, you know, I went past the guards on the end of the stage and everything, and eventually, when I got there, the daddies were at the front of the stage, and they were kind of saying goodbye to everyone. But as I came up, Daddy Gulzar, with a very big smile, presented. She also said something like, "This is a wonderful understanding that you've gained," and she presented me with a teddy bear in a tutu, and a tutu is the little skirt that ballet dancers wear. This teddy bear in a tutu now sits on my desk, and I call it my Western Vishnu. The nice balance between male and female. But it brings back this scene where these daddies sort of deeply congratulated me on pushing through that thing. I'm sorry, Janet, that these things are so individual that I don't know what will kind of further remove your one, but it's great that you're able to speak about it. That might be one of the first steps towards its absolute, well, one of the last steps towards its disappearance. Okay, so let's finish now. Oh, was there one more question, sorry, or shall we finish? Yeah, I think it's time.
We're all going through a journey in Brahman life with lots of highs and lows, and I find it very inspiring that all the Brahmins will be so open and honest and insightful about their experiences in their journey. So can we give Neville another very royal thank you?
Oh, thanks to you for listening through this. It's quite a journey, and I just feel so fortunate that I've had friends and others who have kept me going during tough times. But ultimately, those who manage to push on through, that the rewards are really, really worthwhile. This is truth. This is real. This isn't just some renewal of our old bhakti sanskars, you know, another form of bhakti. This is real. We sometimes live out bhakti sanskars in our Brahmin life, but ultimately we have to go beyond those too to reality of re-empowering the mind through this relationship with this wonderful Father. who just wants us to bring into being that new world now. Om Shanti.